Fencer. Is at Angeles. We're now on season 4, episode 57 of this podcast. And this time we'll be discussing another interesting topic about interpretable machine learning. For today's podcast episode, we have invited Mr. Serge Maces, a seasoned climate and agronomic data scientist at Syngenta from the United States, as he shares with us his valuable insights on the interpretable machine learning and its critical importance to our digital economy. So let's get started. Thank you for listening to FinCircle and welcome to our podcast.
Here's to a fresh start in 2024. FinCircle podcast has been featured by the prominent FeedSpot Media as one of the top 10 best digital economy podcast for 2024. On behalf of the FinCircle podcast team, we would like to express our sincerest gratitude to FeedSpot for this remarkable recognition. We're truly honored and grateful indeed. And this wouldn't be possible without our brilliant guests, generous sponsors, and wonderful podcast listeners who has always been there for the last few years. Thank you all very much for your unwavering support. Stay tuned for more exciting and interesting podcast episodes in the days to come. Let's continue to swipe, tap, or click in our digital journey with FinCircle. Now streaming and available on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Amazon Music, and affiliated podcast platform.
Advanced analytical techniques, coupled with interpretability, will be a boon for the industry, which is recently becoming one of the active research areas in applied AI or artificial intelligence. The future holds promising as AI could potentially solve problems with the rise of augmented intelligence, where both human and artificial intelligence collaborate to drive one solutions. As far as the industry adoption is concerned, the traditional algorithms such as tree-based and linear models are usually the ones that end up being preferred when compared to highly complex non-linear models. This is because of their simplicity and ability to explain the outcome straightforward. Explaining a technique is more important to the business person or stakeholder, benefiting from the solution itself. There's a popular quote in statistics said by George P. E. Box, wherein he stated the following, end quote, "All models are wrong, but some are useful." Unquote. The decision of the model deployment boils down to not only on the accuracy of the model, but also on how actionable the model's behavior is for the business. There could be countless models with high predictive power, but the ones that get preferred are those are able to ease the decision-making process, and it becomes more important to build algorithms that are fairly straightforward and empowers the stakeholder to drive the business objectives. In future, explainable models will definitely become the norm, and hence it will be crucial to build AI solutions that reinforce transparency at the core. And this brings to us the rationale of model selection by integrating interpretability with complex models using this what we call explainable artificial intelligence. In the future, a paradigm shift in AI-guided decision-making will involve extensive use of explainable techniques, wherein the decision arrived by the technique should be capable of being investigated to arrive at appropriate conclusions. Model interpretation using explainable AI is supposed to be done before the stage of model deployment. It is imperative that domain validation happens at this stage, and among those many plausible models, the one that tells the right story about the data is chosen and finalized. One of them is this what we call modal assessment. When done, and it's solely based on the accuracy, it's also prone to introducing biases in decision-making. And the true power of the machine learning model comes into play when it is rigorously tested against the hypothesis and utilize explainable AI techniques to really understand the learning pattern of the algorithm. This step is crucial in getting the expectation so that its behavior in the future is somewhat regulated, and hence the performance does not get affected due to its concept drift. Concept drift, as we call it, happens when the pattern learned by the algorithm is no longer relevant, as an effect of which the predictions made by a model trained in order historical data, for instance, are no longer accurate. And the algorithm might need to be trained on the recent data in order to have the new patterns learned. In the research paper called "Why Should I Trust You? Explaining the Predictions of Any Classifier," the author emphasizes on the importance of trust as a deciding factor to deploy the model, as well as scenarios including choice of models, improving a untrustworthy classifier, and identifying whether a classifier should be trusted or not. Another interesting reference to model interpretation methods is the book entitled Interpretable Machine Learning by Christopher Molnar, wherein he focuses on the interpretable machine learning methods that are appropriate for tabular data. This scenario would be commonly faced by people working on AI problems. Invariably, the time to market for any machine learning or AI product can be reduced drastically if the decision gap is bridged properly. In order to bridge the decision gap, the following factors play a vital role in how the technique adopted would be consumed by the end users. And here are the following. Number one, the key drivers of model prediction. Number two, how the decision was made by the model. And number three, under what scenario might a model predict wrongly? This is quite interesting, to be quite candid about it, because the decision should be made by expert human who can use model interpretation strategies to basically select or reject the model on the basis of the trust, as well as transparency should somehow be established. Nonetheless, as far as the ethics in decision making goes, AI or artificial intelligence could augment decision making, but it should never be allowed to make the decision itself. So there you are, the most interesting and I would say categorically a very good point of discussion between the interpretable machine learning and this is one of the things that will guide us in our future decision making, as well as provide objective to our business decision making process. In today's podcast episode, we'll be talking to Mr. Serge Maces, a seasoned climate and agronomic data scientist at Syngenta from Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, North Carolina in the United States, as he shares with us his insightful views on the challenges and opportunities on the interpretable machine learning and its significant relevance to our digital economy. It's a great privilege to have you, Serge, and welcome to FinCircle.
It's great being here.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Serge. Let's probably start by defining on what is an interpretable machine learning and its value proposition to our digital economy.
Well, it embeds trust in our models. The whole point to have it there. I mean, yeah, a lot of people focus on the ethical aspects, and they're still very valid. But you don't need to be involved in the ethical side to care about trust. You know, everything that is involves financial transactions, business, has to have trust. Otherwise, it's chaos. The whole reason the world works the way it does. It's because at some level we trust each other. You know, if we didn't trust that currency had a value, you know, the whole fiat system would fall apart. If we didn't trust that our credit cards worked when we made purchases, we didn't trust our banks. Same thing. And so, and it's not just financial products; it's any product. So, if you think currency is as a technology, you know, you can extend that to anything. Like, so pretty much everything that's inside our digital economy, including the machine learning models that underpin it, that need to be trustworthy. So that's why you need interpretable machine learning as an exercise in quality assurance, in debugging, in making sure things are working smoothly. And in turn, kind of communicating that to the end user. You know, hey, we know what we're doing. You know, our technology, it works like this. That's basically the value proposition.
Your professional background is quite impressive, Serge. Since you're a climate and agronomic data scientist, what are your main influences and motivation in going to this field of expertise?
What are my motivations? My motivations are about focused on my company and my role there. My motivation is to help in whatever small way with food to be more sustainably grown. For farmers to make better decisions. I'm not saying that farmers make bad decisions. What I'm saying is farmers, unfortunately, because of climate change, because of the pressures of the economy and so forth, it's really hard for them to navigate, you know, even this, you know, what you would think would be the simplest decisions, like what crop to do next, what variety to do next, when to plant, how close to plant, how much fertilizer to use. Like, these decisions, they might seem like trivial, but they're not simple anymore, you know, because we don't know if they're going to have a typhoon come earlier this year, or if they're going to have a disease coming in from a different area that they weren't aware about. So what I do is help develop models that kind of predict these things, and so they can make their risk assessment if you will, and we prescribe solutions as well.
I understand, Serge, that you have a book entitled Interpretable Machine Learning with Phyton, which was released in 2021 and is now becoming the sought-after reference amongst data science professionals and enthusiasts. Perhaps you can tell us more about the book and what should our potential readers expect from it?
Well, they can expect, I mean, it's meant for practitioners, so it's meant for people that already work in machine learning, and they want to be able to enrich their kind of experience, their expertise with how to debug the black box, how to open it up. Because like we're usually trained, the way we're trained to think about machine learning is, okay, well, it's just, you take this, algorithm, and it's gonna train this kind of complicated black box. And what the black box is just a series of mathematical operations that are too complicated for you to actually, anyone to actually like internalize. You know, it's not a formula you can memorize and say, oh, this is the way it works. I mean, I don't think even people with the highest IQ can do that. It's just, they're probably, in some cases, there are millions of operations. So how do we make sense of it as humans? Because they're usually functioning at a higher plane. We're talking about multiple dimensions and hundreds, if not millions of operations. Even the simplest ones might be, you know, if you have 20 variables, you have 20 dimensions, you know. So it can get complicated pretty soon, pretty quickly. So the practitioners want to do is be able to, first and foremost, understand what they're doing, because it gives them direction. I kind of equate it often to, like, when we're doing machine learning or AI, it's like we're the first people working with planes. You know, the plane is a new kind of domain for humans, because humans had never flown before, and the laws of the ground do not apply to the sky, you know. So the same works when you're predicting the future. You know, what we expect from when we're doing other kinds of analytics don't apply there. So when we train a machine learning model, it's like we're flying that plane, and we're just trying to keep it off the ground and making sure, you know, it does something, it lands, you know. So what I tell them is, you need more instruments. You don't want to fly that plane with only like your like two instruments. That might work in the best case scenario, but under worse like data conditions, you know, like the data equivalent to thunderstorms, that's just gonna completely fail. So that's when you hear about models that were, you know, in the training set, they were working perfectly, but when they were set out to the real world, you know, like the executives, they said, okay, this is crap, we're getting these kinds of results, like shut it down, right? So you want to be careful about that stuff. And I think at a basic level, a lot of practitioners understand that there are risks involved, and that they want to be able to understand their models better so they can improve them. It just makes total sense. If you want to improve something, you have to understand it better. If it's not for the end user, it's for yourself, you know. So I don't know how to best describe it, but that's the rationale behind it.
Shifting our focus, Serge, what are the black box algorithms and its relevance to the machine learning process, given its lack of transparency?
Given the lacks of this transparency, I would say that's not really the model's fault. You have a complicated machine, you could say any complicated machine is not transparent. I mean, you could look at a space shuttle and say, okay, and look at all these pipes going all over the place and all the different ships and systems, and you're like, this is not transparent, you know? But that it is what it is. If you need it to go, you need this space shuttle to go into space, you need it to be that complicated. So that's kind of not on the system. It's on us to be able to understand it. It's on us to be able to harness and control it and to become experts in the system. And we can, I mean, it comes to a point where you could say, well, like, we don't have to be experts of everything. But about it, like, I'm sure, like, OpenAI now with ChatGPT has become to an extent where, like, they have an expert on safety moderation, so controlling for it to work with the safety kind of guidelines that they have and all that. So they have experts on that precise part. They have others that whose expertise is on, okay, how do I engage, with the user feedback coming in? How do I make sure that like a new version doesn't screw up a previous version's like advances? People that are more focused on its ability to reason with math. So what does that look like? People that are more focused on retrieval augmented generation framework, which is how you would get like external data and kind of give it to the large language model and make sure that it works, like query your data, that sort of thing, or like summarize an article. So like there's expertise available in different areas because the machine is so complicated, not a single person can work on it. So if we go back to an analogy of a complicated machine, be it a plane, a car, whatever, you don't need like one mechanic. There's specialists that kind of focus on different areas. And the same is going to happen with models, especially the most complicated ones over time. Of course, a lot of people that work in this field, they're not working with foundational models. They have their own custom models. So how do you become an expert on these kind of custom mechanisms that you created for your company? It's less about, like it might not be a humongous machine that warrants like one specialist, but since you're the one that built it, it's on you to be able to understand it the best.
From your perspective, Serge, what is the most common misconception about machine learning in general that somehow needs to be clarified?
I think it's like one of the biggest misunderstandings is it's something that is self-sustaining, that you just throw the data at it and it just figure things out and that's it, and you just let it loose on the world. And that's a very naive way of looking at it. Because if we're thinking about the digital economy and then data is the fuel behind it, well, yeah, it's been the same in the computer science and world for the longest time, garbage in, garbage out. So anything can be data. Even crap can be data. Doesn't necessarily make it useful. And on average, it might be useful. You may take a pile of data and half of it is crap and half of it is gold. And on average, it might be useful. But that's an average. And in the world of predictive analytics, we don't care as much about averages as you would in, say, business intelligence. Because in business intelligence and in other domains of descriptive analytics, you're more interested in like overall trends, like the, maybe what's the trend for sales for the next month, or what are the categories in which our products are, being bought at in the over the last quarter? So those numbers might check out, month after month, and so people are satisfied. But beneath of it all, the data is not in a good state. There's a lot of records that are incorrect, incomplete, ones that are not meant to be there, that are just accidents, or that have been tampered with. And so when you take that data and you try to apply it to, you know, machine learning, it's like we need jet fuel. We need that data to be refined. We need it to be, I wouldn't say flawless, but almost. And the reason for it is because we're not working with those like broad strokes. You know, we're not interested in just the totals and the averages. Like every data point matters, because every data point could be, you know, the closest data point to where you want to go. So like if we're trying to predict a specific kind of customer, and the only record you have for something similar to that customer is misleading, of course what it's going to predict is going to be misleading. It's not going to work. So that's why it has to be a lot better. And I think the misconception is, you know, if it's good, it continued to be good. Like if I told an executive in a company, I've had these conversations before in the previous company I worked for, we have a data problem, the data's crap. And they'll tell you, no, well, we have a bunch of data analysts and they don't complain about our data. But they're operating, they're trying to do something else than what I'm trying to do. And what you're asking me to do is impossible with the data I have. So I think that's a big misconception.
That's a very good point, Serge. Moving on, what are the hurdles that you have encountered in your field of work during these past few years? And what are your relevant takeaways from these challenging experiences?
Well, I think the challenge is the space is changing. There's a lot of new things we're learning, new frameworks, new models, new trends. At the same time, and this is just on the machine learning end. Of course, if you add it, other parts of the stack, you know, what has happened with data engineering, what has happened with MLOps, what has happened to, you know, even data analytics. I mean, if you add all those things up, it's just enormous what's happened in just the last 2 years, let alone five, you know. So I think the learning curve is pretty steep for anybody in the area in working this area. And so that's probably the biggest challenge. The other one is since there's a lot of different cooks in the kitchen, there's a lot of like different specialties coming about, and more people interested, and companies more aggressively moving into predictive analytics. Like what's happening to the space is people are becoming, it's like a pressure cooker. There's more pressure coming in, and there's more interest, and there's more kind of opportunity for people to maybe not, I wouldn't say not get along, but, you know, for them to be friction, because we're all coming from different angles. There's people whose contribution is more on like the governance side, on the data governance. There's people that are more interested in that algorithms, and they couldn't care less about the governance. And then there's people that are interested in data pipelines, and they just want to create all the pipelines and make them flow. So like there's different angles to all of it. And so how do we make sure that we go in the right direction? It's complicated in any structure that's brand new, because it hasn't been tested, it hasn't been tried. There isn't, as much as people will make it out to be, that it's not really at a level where I could say, okay, data science is a mature discipline, you know. I think it isn't, you know, it's evolved so much. It has been hard to establish standards and norms that have tried to that have tested the passing of time.
Shifting gears, Serge, What is a monotonicity in the context of data science?
Oh, it's a very important concept. A lot of people focus on correlation. Correlation being important, and it is. And of course, correlation is generally like evidence to causation, but not the other way around. Well, what I mean about that is that you can't necessarily say something is causal just because it's correlated, but it might lead to that assumption if you know what you're doing, if you actually have domain expertise to kind of say so. And then, but the bigger question is, a lot of people are looking at data and seeing all these patterns, and they're saying, well, I want it to a linear relationship. I want it to be perfect. And that's not necessarily what we're looking for. What we're looking is for a general trend, and that's where monotonicity comes from. I think it's a better idea of there being a proper relationship between two variables, and especially like a variable of interest and outcome variable. So that's when we can get to say something like, generally, when this variable goes, it increases, this one decreases. Or when this one decreases, this other one decreases. So we hear that a lot in many cases. Like, say you go to the doctor and they say, well, as your age increases, your, you know, so-and-so blood variable will increase or decrease. It's just normal. It's expected. You're like, oh, okay. So you know there's a connection between both. You know, like, of course, like, and there's other things, you know, as your weight increases, your risk of cardiovascular disease increases. And for every domain of human life, of every kind of phenomenon exists, there are relationships like this, and they're monotonic. And the reason they're monotonic is because there's always an expectation of something moving along with something else. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's linear. It doesn't mean there's room for it to actually not move always in a smooth direction, as long as they're both moving in the same direction. So there's many ways of drawing that graph in such a way where it's monotonic, but it's not linear. So in statistics, people get caught up on things being linear. And that, in an ideal world, that would be beautiful. But being as data is messy, monotonicity is a better expectation for a lot of different relationships. So I watch for monotonicity. I think it is a very good way of figuring out if something has a relationship. And it's very easy to spot visually if two variables are monotonic. And when they are, this is another beautiful thing. You can set it as a guardrail. And by guardrail, I mean, if your machine learning model is predicting in such a way where it breaks the monotonicity of two variables that are naturally monotonic, you have a problem. And you can set it in such a way in which your model is protecting that relationship. So that's called a monotonic constraint. And I highly recommend it.
Very interesting concept, indeed. Looking ahead, Serge, what's your outlook on the future of interpretable machine learning?
Well, I think it all has to do with adoption. I mean, it might take a while. Like, interpretable machine learning is about empowering practitioners. It's about digging deeper. And I think a big issue right now is that people are caught up on a lot of different things that don't help in that regard. Of course, like, a lot of companies are still building data infrastructure so they can produce good models. They're still up training their data scientists so they learn the latest like cloud infrastructure tools. So they can't be bothered with, you know, interpretable machine learning. It's at a different level. You know, like, And so it is kind of hard to kind of make sure that in my view, everybody should be using interpretable and machine learning. To me, it's kind of crazy that there is such a thing as uninterpretable machine learning, you know. And it doesn't really make sense that not every practitioner is using it. But when you think about it, it's just like, okay, we have all these demands from our practitioners, and on top of them, they're going to ask them to, you know, debug the hell out of their models. I think there's a second part to it, which is like, you often what we're trying to do is like, and it's not a question about being lazy, we're just trying to get something out into the market. So we're just trying to get out our first model. And it doesn't have to be perfect. That's fine. But when the time opportunity comes to make a second one, I think the mistake there is, okay, for the second version of my model, I'm just going to throw more data at it. And there's a focus on quantity and not quality. And that's a flaw. I think there's plenty of opportunity to not only increase the quality with the data, but also with the model. And if you use interpretable machine learning, it can guide you on both ends. It can guide you to, oh, where do I need more data? Where do I need better data? You know, where are the gaps? It can guide you in that. And it can guide you as to what mistakes might have done with the model. Why is it like doing this? Oh, I can add constraints. Oh, that's cool. I should have done that. Or, you know, I should have made it more robust by, you know, doing this or this other thing. So there are a lot of different techniques that can be used to increase the model, which is why my book is roughly split into three parts. The first part is like an introduction, you know, and then the second part is, this is how you kind of debug a machine learning model. This is how you interpret it. This is how you look under the hood. And when you think about mechanics, they don't just look under the hood. When they find a problem, they're like, oh, this, I'll go ahead and fix it. Like, let me get my wrench and I'll fix this. And so that's where the third part of the book comes in. The third part is about fixing problems. So that might be making the model more fair, make it more consistent, make it more robust, and make it more interpretable, because interpretable is also a property. It's something that they teach you in statistics, but it's plenty lost on practitioners that don't have that training, which is less is more. The more, you know, often, especially with the more complicated models, you want to throw every variable at it. But the reality is that with each variable, you're adding complexity, and sometimes it's not even worth it. You add a variable that will maybe increase your accuracy by 0.03%, and then so what? You know, if it's going to actually worsen the you know, its consistency over time, if it's going to make it less reliable, you know, in a few months when it hits an unforeseen scenario. So that's a way of making things more interpretable by reducing the complexity.
Given your wealth of experience in this field, Serge, any word of advice that you can give to our data science professionals and enthusiasts with regards to this subject matter?
Okay. I would say start simple. Like, if you're starting out, that's something that's pretty large. You want to go through the shining ball. So if you're starting out, I mean, if I was starting out and I was, say, like 20 years old and really naive about it, I'd be like, wow, I want to get into deep learning. I want to become an expert in large language models. And there you go. This is going to be my career. So they're going to jump directly towards that. They're going to skip some important steps. And they might not be immediately important. You know, you might be able to operate completely well for the first year or two or three with that lack of knowledge. But I think over time, it's going to become apparent. And I think it's important to grasp the foundation of things. And I think the foundation doesn't have to be, okay, go off and study like five different calculuses and get a PhD. No, I'm just talking about more basic building blocks. So say your interest is large language models. Learn about natural language processing. Learn about embeddings. Learn about how different relationships work within language. It's pretty much, you don't have to become a linguistic scholar, but understand how different forms of different words follow some orders. So in certain languages, subject object verb, or verb object subject, and so you understand how that works. And it's a little bit going back to grammar, but the important part about it is that when you look at it from that angle, and say for the first time someone asks, oh, I want you to fine-tune my large language model with this data set, you know how to clean it, you know how to approach it. You're just not throwing anything into it, because you might realize the strategy to kind of prepare that data is gonna require some special finesse to it. Like, for instance, you might be working with private information. Like a couple of years ago, I was working on a project for a company that was doing a chatbot for folks that had issues with substance abuse. So that can be a very sensitive topic, and you want to make sure that private information is, when it's shared, it's not stored. If it's used for retraining, it's kind of removed. And there's also, since it's very sensitive information, people are pretty shy about communicating about certain words. They use euphemisms. They use like a different set of language than you would expect. So if you train a model, a foundation model out there, it's not necessarily going to mirror what you need for this kind of chatbot. But there's a lot of things that you can do with it. And so understanding, what you should watch out for is you have to learn about a lot of large natural language processing techniques to be able to understand how to kind of dissect that and figure out what's the best approach, not just to prepare it, but maybe to do other like downstream tasks. Like say you wanted to channel like a chat based on maybe the first question or the first few questions to a specialist, and say, okay, if it seems like the person is talking about medication, or they want to get in touch with your doctor for a treatment, send them to a doctor. If they're contemplating suicide, send them here. You can't just expect the large language model to understand how to do this on its own. It needs some examples. It needs some guidance. So I think it's important for someone starting to figure out that there's generally a path. They can skip some steps, but it's really important to kind of cover that eventually. Become engaged with the tools, even the earlier tools, to the task they're trying to accomplish or the things they want to learn about, become interested in like the domain expertise in the field. And in this example I told you, it might be, okay, how do these outreach programs and clinics that work with people that have issues with substance abuse, how do they generally work? What are their goals? If you don't know anything about it, it's important that you do, because a big part of what we do in data science involves getting domain expertise and encoding it into algorithms and data processes and models. So you don't have that domain expertise, you have no business doing that.
Very well said. Are there any initiatives that you're working on, Serge, that you would like to share with our podcast listening audience? And most importantly, what are the easiest way of reaching you?
Oh, sure. One of the, the project I'm very excited about and working right now is called Do It Yourself AI. I've been working on it on and off for the last 2 years. It's been a little bit of a challenge because there's been so many changes in the space. When I first presented my this book to a publisher 2 months, two years ago, actually, the techniques kind of described in the book were so different to the ones that are used right now, because a lot of the things we're discussing right now, the you know, the ones that are used for, like, say diffusion, stable diffusion wasn't yet a thing 2 years ago. And if it was, it was only, I think it was, but only known in certain circles that were working on it, but not the general public. So I started kind of working on it, and then I realized too much is changing right now. Let's pause it for a bit and then resume work a year ago. And then there's been a lot of start and stop, because things are still changing. They're changing less, but they're still changing. So, but the whole point of the book is, let's get a lot of techniques and tools and all this interest about AI and kind of merge them together. Because I think there's a lot of people that are technically capable, but they're intimidated by AI. They're intimidated about, oh, I can't do that. You know, it, you know, only these people over here that have PhDs can do that. And that's usually not the case. I think it's the tool, the AI has matured to the point that it doesn't really, you don't need to have a math degree to work on it. It's important to understand some of the fundamentals, but depending on what you're doing, it might not be necessary. So what is the book about? The book is about a lot of things we've heard about in the media that, you know, we figure, well, you know, that's just cool and it's interesting, but you haven't yet engaged with it. Or maybe you have, but only through someone else's system. You don't know you can create your own system. And so, like, for instance, there's a chapter on facial recognition. There's another one on sound classification. There's one on pose and action recognition. There's one on chatbots. So why do these things matter? It means, like, because I think if you give the power to the people, you tell them, go work, go play with this, they're going to come up with some cool things, you know, and maybe even useful for themselves. So they can create a facial recognition for their home. They can create an action recognition system to detect when they're, you know, say they waved at the camera and then they do something funny with that, you know, maybe even change something in a, you know, put a glove on the hand or something like that. There's so many things they could do. They could play with the tool that could lead to some kind of either personal or even general breakthrough. And more importantly, I think it's also when you make the technology more accessible to people, it eventually people are going to break it and it gets better. You know, by break it is they're going to find flaws. They're going to find ways of exploiting it, either by accident or on purpose. They're going to find different opportunities to improve it, to new kind of applications for it. And that this is all about making it more resilient. So it's taking what people are working on from a completely like a business oriented level and back to the consumer for the consumer to pitch in. And then I think this is how you mature a technology appropriately. I think we saw the same thing happen with the internet when pretty much everybody was making websites. And some of them were ugly and hardly would load, but that's not the point. The point is you're this is part of the road to making it function for everybody. And we can talk all we want about responsible AI. It's not going to be responsible till it's accessible. So that's kind of my next project, and that's why I'm excited about it.
And how will they reach you or search?
LinkedIn. They can find me through LinkedIn. They can find me through Threads, through Twitter. I think those are pretty much the social medias I that connect to the most. And I have a personal website. They can find me there as well. Surge.ai.
Well, thanks so much, Serge, for sharing us your valuable insights on the challenges and opportunities on the interpretable machine learning and its significant relevance to our digital economy. We wish you great success in the future.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Our sincere appreciation to Mr. Serge Mazes on sharing us his insightful views on interpretable machine learning and its critical importance to our digital economy. We would like to hear from you. Share us your thoughts regarding our topics and send us a message on the Anchor Voice message box. Your message could end up on our future podcast episode. Make sure you never miss any episodes of FinCircle by clicking the subscribe button or follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Radio Public, Amazon Music, Pocket Cast, Audible, Overcast, TuneIn, CastBox, iHeartRadio, Anchor.fm, and affiliated podcast platforms. You can also reach us on our website at fincircle.wordpress.com and our Facebook page at FinCircle Podcast. This concludes our podcast episode today. Thank you for listening on FinCircle. This is Ed Angelus. Let's catch up again soon.